Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest on today's show is Dr. Jennifer Conrad, a veterinarian and the founder of the Paw Project. Dr. Conrad has functioned as a tireless crusader against declawing cats for many, many years. I first interviewed her about it on Talking Animals in 2005, and she'd already been working on the issue for some time. In the ensuing 20 years, she's made more appearances on the show than I think just about any other guest. The numerous appearances on the program underscore both the enormous importance of the issue and the myriad ways Conrad has sought to communicate the anti-declaw message. These include her formation of a multifaceted organization, the Paw Project, and even making an acclaimed documentary film also called the Paw Project, which chronicled an array of issues and experiences pertinent to the anti-declaw realm, often with the cinematic verve of a political thriller. Additionally, Conrad has played a pivotal role in legislative efforts to impose declaw bans, beginning in West Hollywood back in 2003, up through the most recent legislative victories and inroads, including the passing last month of an anti-declaw law in California, the largest state to implement such a ban. We'll discuss all that and more when I speak with Dr. Conrad in just a moment or two here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later in the program, I'll speak with Rick Schabody, president of Suncoast Animal League, who fill us in on the triumphant return of Suncoast Dogtoberfest. Not coincidentally, also the triumphant return of Ride for the Animals, both happening this Saturday, November 15th at Highlander Park in Dunedin. We'll hear more of this when Rick joins us later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss, among other topics, the feline declaw procedure, why you should avoid it, and why it's being outlawed in more and more states, with a key figure in this realm, Dr. Jennifer Conrad. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ@WMF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Jennifer Conrad back to Talking Animals on WMF. Good morning, Dr. Conrad.
Good morning, Duncan. Nice to talk with you.
Oh, it's great to talk with you again. I feel like, you know, we've talked a lot over the years, as I just noted, but it's been a few years, I think, since the last time we spoke. So it's great to kind of catch up on what's been happening in the declaw realm and just generally. So, in fact, we kind of established in the introduction, you've been working hard on the declaw issue for about a quarter century or thereabouts. And we first discussed it here on this show 20 years ago. But remind me, what was the initial impetus for your involvement?
I was taking care of big cats after I finished vet school, and many of them had been declawed to in a false attempt to make them more manageable. And they were limping and in pain, and because they had lost their primary way of defending themselves, they became biters. And I thought, as a young veterinarian, I'm going to see if I can do something to repair or at least salvage their paws so they're not in so much pain. And that's how it started. I had about 40 big cat patients, and once we started addressing their paws, which were also, I mean, very often infected because the nails were growing under the skin. When you amputate the last bone in a cat's toe, which is what you have to do in order to effectively remove the claw, very often that causes so much pathology that these cats were in so much pain. And once we surgically addressed their paws to remove the bits of bone or nail that were still under the skin, these cats were miraculously better, and that sent me on this journey.
So you basically sort of looked at your experience with the big cats and said, okay, let me take what I can apply over to regular old house cats.
Exactly. Well, what happened was there was a deputy to the mayor of West Hollywood who came to see me because he knew what I was doing with the big cats, and he had just found an abandoned declaw cat, and that the combination of him having access to the city council and being absolutely against declawing was what made me flippantly say, let's ban declawing in West Hollywood. And I thought veterinarians would be really happy about not having to do such a horrible thing to an animal. And but they weren't, because, as you know, it is $1 billion a year business easily.
So there was just too much money at stake back then, or I guess at various points along the way up through, including now, I guess, in many regards.
Yes, there's a lot of money. I mean, there's no question that every veterinarian who performs the surgery knows it's wrong, but also knows that on average they make $900 for a surgery that takes about 10 minutes.
Wow. Is that, boy, I don't know if we've talked in the past about that figure, or at least it translating so directly to that kind of dough. But so we're just kind of skipping around, I guess, because as part of your story, you know, I'm sure the question that people listening might have, or certainly we've touched on before, is the procedure you were doing on the big cats that kind of spurred your interest in transferring some information and efforts to the little cats. Can there be a procedure like the ones you were performing on those big cats?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just harder to do in the little tiny paws, but the idea is to remove whatever bits of fragmented bone shards that were left in the original declaw, and also to replace the toe bean, the digital pad, underneath the toe bones, so that the cat has some cushion instead of walking on skin, basically. Because see, what happens when you remove the last declawing, by the way, just for anyone who doesn't know, should be really called de-knuckling. It is the removal of the last knuckle in a cat toes. And when you do that, the digital pad, the toe bean, shifts backward because there's no anatomy to hold it forward. And the second knuckle in the cat toes becomes like a hammer toe. And that very often is just right on, against the skin. So the cat's walking on with no pad, and that hurts so much that the cat changes the way it walks, and then they get arthritis and they get cranky and they bite more and they don't want to use the litter box because their paws hurt.
Well, that's a big string of ill effects from one procedure. And yeah, I think it's you can't underscore too much how declaw, because again, I think people picture, as I first did before I knew about it, you know, somebody getting a little clipper out of their manicure kit or whatever and saying, okay, come over here, kitty, and here's a simple little clip of your nail. But as you've mentioned already, and we've mentioned in the past, of course, many times, that's nothing like that at all. It's an actual amputation, and there's bone involved, and therefore all the consequences that you've outlined as far as walking and biting, because they can't use their claws because they're basically gone. So I guess they bite that much more when they're in any kind of encounter or upset. And then there's litter box issues, which again gets them sent elsewhere often because people can't take dealing with the litter box issues. So there's a myriad of problems that come just from one procedure that's lucrative, but disastrous, basically.
Exactly. It's disastrous. It has no benefit to the cat. It has no benefit to the people who have the cat, because a declawed cat doesn't use the litter box very often and bites more. It has no benefit to the veterinarian, because very often what will happen is the veterinarian will do the procedure. The people who have the cat will say, this veterinarian's a quack because my cat has been destroyed by it. They lose the patient, and then it has no benefit to the community, because declawed cats end up in the shelters all the time, in the pound, on the euthanasia list, because of their behavior problems. Remember that if someone is intolerant of a cat scratching a couch, and so they go to get the cat declawed, they're going to be way more intolerant of the cat peeing on the couch or biting everybody. So
they didn't know how good they had it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is why declawed cats lose their home. And you ask any shelter worker, and they know that these declawed cats are coming in because they're not using the litter box and because they're biting.
And Dr. Conrad, is what you've described, is that pretty much inevitable? Like, a cat being declawed equals those kind of issues, or it varies from cat to cat to what extent they have those issues or how severe they are?
Well, what happens is, if you declaw a cat when it's just a tiny, tiny baby, which is very often what veterinarians prefer to do, then the cat will adapt. Just like if you remove the foot of a human toddler when that is a young, very young toddler, that individual will adapt. But when they get older, they get arthritis, because they've changed the way they walk, and most people don't realize in older cats who stop using the litter box or start biting, very often has to do with the declaw.
So that might develop a little bit later over time, may or may not happen sort of in the immediate aftermath of the declaw procedure.
Exactly. And so many people, when they've declawed a kitten, will say, I don't have any of those problems with my kitten. But then when the cat becomes 12, 15 years old and is not using a litter box, they won't realize it has to do with the declaw.
Just because it's so kind of latent in terms of that development in that cat's career.
It has to do with impairing the way the cat has walked, and the cat can compensate.
Right, and it catches up with
older.
Them.
Yeah.
I got you. So we're kind of into a little bit of declaw 101. Maybe let's go a bit more. So what's the history? I was saying in preparation for speaking to you again, we might have talked about this, but I couldn't quite recall. Can it be traced to the declaw procedure? Can it be traced to a specific veterinarian or practice? I mean, how did it begin? Like, why was that first performed and under what circumstances and how long ago?
So in 1952, a veterinarian named Grant Meisner in the Chicago area wrote a letter to the editor. So that, mind you, that is not peer-reviewed. A letter to the editor to the Journal of the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, and said, hey, here's a way to keep cats indoors. I take a guillotine and I chop their toes off after sedating them with the medication that we use to kill them.
And Jesus.
So he took it on a dog and pony show around, and the AVMA they supported it. They gave him a platform, and so it took off in the United States. It took off in Canada, but when he took it to Europe, they said that's basically sadism, and they didn't start doing it. They thought it was horrible. But in the United States, it was a way to supersize a spay or neuter, you know, add that money to a spay or neuter. And the letter to the editor is so disturbing because he says after 72 or 96 hours, the cats are not in pain at all. And you think about this. This is amputating their toe bone. Of course they're in pain.
Yeah.
And he just had no empathy or no recognition of pain in cats. And ultimately, this surgery took off it became so prevalent that in the Midwest, there are certain veterinary practices who say that 80% of the cats who come in are declawed. If you do a survey across the United States, it's somewhere around 25% of American cats are declawed. So that's one in four.
Wow.
The effort to ban it has been very hard because the veterinary medical associations of each state and the big one, the American Veterinary Medical Association, they don't want to lose that income. It's a huge amount of money. It's $1 billion a year business. And as I said, for a very short time, most veterinarians are using a guillotine, like a dog nail clipper, to declaw cats. So they're chopping off the bones with a guillotine, and that's why it's so quick. And the problem is that veterinarians know it's wrong. It's bad for veterinarians, and I believe veterinarians who are forced to do it are I think they're struggling with it because it's morally wrong. They know it. It's not ethical. They know it. But to make that much money is also on their agenda.
So this would be like what you're alluding to. There might be a vet that's employed at a clinic or hospital, and they do declaw, but this particular vet is torn about it or worse, but sort of feels like, well, that's part of the job. That's part of being employed here. So then I guess they have to sort out whether they want to keep working there or look for some other job, or they wouldn't have to do declaw, which wouldn't necessarily be guaranteed, I guess, depending on what kind of research they could do.
Well, I think so. And I think that's why we chose to, the Paw Project has chosen to make it illegal. So it's on the legislature is dictating it because veterinarians have clearly failed to police themselves on this. The AVMA says in their position statement on declawing, they say how bad declawing is, but then that the vet should just do it if they want to. And that's why it has to be the legislature saying you can't do it. And that's why we're excited to say that, you know, New York banned declawing in 2019. It was the first state, and then Maryland and Massachusetts and Rhode Island and California. Now, the legislature speaking, it is bipartisan supported, and if you want to find out more about it, there's a documentary called American Cats, The Good, the Bad, and the Cuddly, which is streaming on multiple platforms. And it's about how Republicans and Democrats can, they agree on one thing, and that is that decoying is bad.
And just to back up a little bit, Dr. Conrad, so in the wake of when this Dr. Meissner came up with this, why ostensibly did he come up with it, and then why did it catch on? Were there issues that he was felt he was trying to solve, or that people in the wake of his innovation, and putting in air quotes, were such that other veterinarians, would follow suit?
Yeah, I think what happened was he said, hey, here's an easy way to prevent a cat from scratching the couch. But what he failed to realize is that behavioral issues need to be addressed by a behaviorist, not by surgery. He chose surgery because he had no idea about how to behavior modulate a cat. He had no idea. He did not recommend putting scratching pads or scratching posts or cat trees in the house. He just said, let's go right to surgery because that is a very permanent way to remove the claws. A horrible thing to do. And in human medicine, obviously, we know that surgery is not how you address a behavior problem. That went out with lobotomy. Cat, it's a natural behavior for them to mark a couch by scratching it. It means this is my person, this is my home. It's a way to tell other cats that this is their territory, and it should not be modified by surgery. Surgery should be reserved for anatomical pathology, for a tumor in the toe. And all the legislation that is made allows a cat to have a toe removed if there's a tumor or some reason that the anatomy is compromised, but none of it allows it for reasons of convenience or ways to keep the cat.
Behavioral issues, I guess, yeah.
Right, and we also have to recognize something that's really important for anyone who's ambivalent about what I'm talking about, is that declaw bans actually save lives. Fewer cats end up in the shelters on the kill list if we ban declawing, because these cats are not biting and they're not avoiding the litter box. So regular cats don't bite people all the time and they don't avoid the litter box all the time, and declawed cats do. So declawing actually is a way of having these cats end up on the kill list. It's declaw and then death. It's not declaw or death. Declawing does not save lives.
Yeah, I guess there's part of why we're having this kind of conversation, and there's been so many over the years, and it comes down to legislation, I guess, is there's just so many misconceptions about declawing and what it does and why it should happen. And I guess people that are concerned about the couch being scratched or whatever prompts them to do it without knowing necessarily what they're getting into. And I guess that's where a vet would be sort of, you would hope, you would think, inclined to say, hey, that's kind of drastic. Here's what you're going up against to cure what you think is the clawing of the couch problem. But I guess there's that $900 sitting there that's making it a tough sort of good, bad thing on the shoulder of a person, vet saying, should I advise them or should I not, based on losing the $900.
Yeah, and then if the vet has purchased a $45,000 laser, then the vet has 45,000 reasons to declaw cats. And they're not going to, those vets are not going to say, hey, you know, you realize I'm amputating your cat's toe bone, and that there are humane alternatives that are easy to use, and the cat and you will both be happier. I mean, declawing is really an anomaly in the United States and part of Canada. It did not take off anywhere else in the world. So those people living in the rest of the world aren't dying from cat scratches. And cats in those parts in the rest of the world aren't losing their homes because they're scratching couches. Like, you know, in England, they revere cats very much. In Japan, they revere cats very, I mean, those, we know those things about those societies. And those cats are living in houses and they're not getting declawed, and somehow the couches are surviving.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you kind of how our track record stacked up internationally, and it sounds like in kind of without getting into ton of specifics. Most countries don't even get close to thinking about having banned declaw because it's not an issue to begin with.
Right, and they don't have to because they would never do it. And if you look at many countries in their Veterinary Practice Act, they say you can't amputate healthy tissues just because of convenience. So we know that the United States is behind on this. And I think that the more that we educate people that this surgery should be called denuckling, not declawing, and that it's something you would never want to do to your cat, then veterinarians will stop having that $900 on the table, and maybe they'll reawaken their ethics and say, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like in the meantime, their hand has to be kind of forced with legislation in the meantime to get there. So
And also, I was just going to say that American Cats, The Good, the Bad, and the Cuddly, the documentary that's out right now, it's asking the AVMA, why would you not say this is below the standard of care? The rest of the world knows declawing is below the standard of care. Why aren't you saying so? And I think the answer, and the AVMA obviously won't answer me specifically, but I think the answer is because if they were to say that, they would lose a lot of members who pay dues.
Wow. So once again, we see, without being too cynical, how everything comes down to the all great dollar.
Yes.
So this is Talking Animals. I'm Dr. Sessi. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Jennifer Conrad, a veterinarian and founder of the Paw Project, whose advocacy for halting and banning the declawing of cats has spanned the better part of a quarter of a century. She's played a pivotal role in legislative efforts to outlaw the procedure. California did so just last month. She made a declaw focus and acclaimed documentary film on this. If you'd like to ask Dr. Conrad a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Let's take a caller actually right now. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Jennifer Conrad.
Is it me?
Yes, go ahead. It is you.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you. This is Jackie. I'm calling from Sarasota, and I just wanted to make a comment. Years ago, I had a neighbor that had the best treatment for behavioral problems, and it was a simple little water pistol. And whenever the cat was doing something that she didn't want to do, she would squirt it with the water pistol, and it was trained for inside. Even outdoors, she would let the cat out and sit out there in a chair, and if her cat started digging up her plants, she'd squirt it with the water pistol and change the behavior. How simple is that?
And there was never any amputation of the cat's claws, it sounds like.
No, I don't think there was ever any even thought of it.
Right. The water pistol sort of took care of everything, apparently.
Right. They don't like water, you know, especially a squirt in the face, you know. So it was very effective, and it was totally harmless.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Conrad, any response for Jackie before we move along?
I appreciate the fact that the neighbor did not declaw the cat or did not resort to amputating the toe bones, I think that there are also other ways that cats can be trained, and one of them is to find a high-value treat, and when the cat does the right thing, give the cat the treat and not have a punishment, but rather a reward for doing the right thing. I think that is a nicer way to treat cats. But I appreciate that the cat was not declawed.
Yeah, I don't think it was. It didn't seem to be an unhappy cat, you know.
Yeah, I think Dr. Conrad is suggesting there might have been an alternative to the water pistol. But either way, everybody is glad there was no amputation involved. So we're ahead
right,
of the, yeah. We're ahead of the game there.
Right. Yeah, treats are always a good stimulus for good behavior.
For sure. All right, Jackie.
Okay,
thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Duncan. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you. So, just as a quick side note, Dr. Conrad, I've kind of long wondered for you, what would you say is the second most important issue? In other words, if you hadn't spent so much time and energy and resources working on the declaw issue, is there another issue that would be sort of second in line to get your attention to get those kind of efforts?
Well, I'm very motivated by cats and the fact that they're the underdogs. I think that what's important to me is that people recognize that cats are sentient beings, as are so many of the animals that we have encounters with every day, because I think all animals have they want to survive. They want to live a peaceful life. They don't want to be tortured by humans. So I think it's really important that we begin to expand our understanding of animals, and that they have emotions, and that they feel pain, and that they feel happiness, and that we should just allow the fact that nature would not have made animals the way that they are. The human beings are not exceptional in this. Animals also feel emotions and want to maintain their lives, and we shouldn't be killing them, and we should be more respectful, because they have so much to offer us. And we could learn so much from them.
Yeah. Well, given that that cat fondness and bias, I guess, is maybe even the right term, you created the Paw Project. Talk a little bit about the Paw Project. Why did you create it back when you did it, and what does it do overall?
The Paw Project, which is pawproject.org, is the world's largest nonprofit dedicated solely to ending the declawing of cats, the de-knuckling of cats. I created it because I decided that I love cats, and I love cat paws. They're really extraordinary. And the fact that my fellow veterinarians would choose to destroy the paw, and therefore in so many ways destroy the happiness and function of the cat, I decided that's why I had to make a nonprofit. And the nonprofit has been behind all the legislation in North America to end declawing. We've been part of it. And I'm really proud of that. It's never enough, because since we've only banned declawing in 5 states, and Virginia, by the way, has banned declawing, but they have such a giant loophole in the legislation that I don't really consider it banned. But I need everyone to help on this. I need people to tell each other what declawing is. If you meet someone who just gets some cats, and they might succumb to a veterinarian saying, let's declaw them when we spay or neuter them. And people have to understand that, no, never declaw a cat. There is no reason to declaw a cat. There are so many reasons not to declaw a cat.
And also, Dr. Conan, on a related note, sometimes those things are presented as kind of, I don't know how they're labeled or described necessarily, but those are sometimes often packages. You just adopt a cat, or you end up with a cat, and you go to the vet, and there's like a quote-unquote package where they're spayed and neutered and maybe chipped and whatever, and as part of that, they are often declawed. And I don't know how much conversation, once again, there is about the declaw part of that, or if it's just like, hey, I got a great overall package for my new cat that we just adopted over the weekend, and never much discussion about what that actually involves.
Exactly, and a lot of people fall for the fact that if a veterinarian recommended it, it can't be bad for the cat. But actually, it is. It's bad for the cat, and the only way that we're going to stop this is by educating all people who love cats and who have cats that declawing has no benefit for anyone. And going to veterinarians who won't declaw. Now, in 2020, the Paw Project was able to influence VCA, which is the huge corporation of veterinarians, and Banfield to stop offering declawing in all their hospitals. Why? Because they know that veterinarians who don't declaw actually make more money, because the cats, they retain their patients, they retain their vet staff, because they don't have to see these cats flailing around and bleeding all over the inside of the cage. Mm-hmm. After being declawed. So veterinarian corporations have now led the industry and said, we need to stop. But the Veterinary Medical Association, which are the trade associations, they will not admit that declawing is below the standard of care. So veterinarians who want to do it can do it with impunity.
Wow. Well, on a related note, one key feature on the Paw Project website, which again is pawproject.org, is a section where you can search for veterinarians across the U.S. and Canada who will not declaw a cat. And, you know, of course, naturally, I searched Florida and was pleased to see actually a number of clinics and hospitals turn up. Maybe not a huge number proportionate to the size of the state and the population, but still, I was glad to see some. This might lead us back to the topic of legislation, because anyone who spent much time in and around animal welfare or otherwise seeking to protect animals knows that the most effective way to really affect meaningful change and truly protect animals is to create or fortify, in some cases, legislation. So just a few weeks ago, California did officially ban the practice of declawing cats, and you mentioned a few other states that have done it prior to that. So perhaps looking at the California victory or any other maybe better example, if there is one, walk me through the process of generating the kind of support that can translate to the passage of a statewide declaw ban and what's all involved.
Well, first of all, what we have to do is identify an author, meaning a legislator in either the House side of things or the Senate side of things, who will be an advocate for cats. Because one of the ways that the veterinary medical associations kill these bills is they put a poison pill in it, meaning they put language in it that we will not accept so that we end up killing it ourselves. Mm. Like, for instance, they will put language that you can declaw a cat if you're afraid of being scratched, or you can declaw a cat if there's someone who's a baby or an elderly person or someone thin skin or someone on Coumadin in the house. These things we won't accept because that is just an exception that will swallow the rule. So if someone wants to pass legislation in the state, we have to find an author who is absolutely committed to having the bill have integrity and not having these giant loopholes. Then we have to start working with rallying all the people who care about cats in that state. And we have to work on getting legislators to understand that the veterinary medical associations, the trade organizations who are going to absolutely oppose the bill, that their only motivation is to keep the bottom line for veterinarians who declaw up. They want to keep the money in the veterinarians who declaw pocket, and that is their only motivation. They don't care about the cats. They don't care about anything else. It's just money. And if we can convince the legislators that that's their motivation for opposing the bill, it becomes easier.
Wow. Sounds like a slow uphill battle with all the funny business of people putting stuff in the bills that they know are just going to basically kill the bill. And is there one or more states that are kind of on the cusp that you think of doing what California did?
Yes, I do think that Washington State and Oregon will follow in the next couple years.
Okay.
I do think that there's legislation in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey and other states that I think will take a long time. But as people realize, as legislators realize that this is what the public wants, that declawing is such an important issue to so much of the public that they support it. Legislators often comment that they've never had more people interested in this legislation than any other legislation they've ever put forth. And it's because people care about cats. And so once legislators realize they're not sticking their necks out and being animal rights people, they're just doing what's right, then legislators feel more comfortable pushing it forward.
And also, Dr. Conrad, aren't there places like California, an example of this, where on a municipal or other level there are kind of local bans already in place? So does that help for people to sort of stitch those together, especially if they're an author? Say, well, this state has so far, this city and this region, this area that have already put declaw bans in. So I think we have a chance of building on that. Is that
absolutely, absolutely. And what's interesting is that, for instance, in Los Angeles, which is a big city, it's over 4 million people, we banned declawing in 2009. If you look at the numbers of cats who were dumped in the pound before the ban, let's say 5 years before the ban versus the 5 years after the ban was implemented, you see a drastic decline in the number of cats dumped in the pound after the ban was implemented. And the head of LA Animal Services even commented that because of the ban, tens of thousands of cats, 43% decline in the number of cats dumped in the pound after the ban. So the comment is that it's saving people money by not allowing declawing. It is saving communities money. They're not having to destroy these declawed cats. And I think that translates to everyone. Everyone understands that saving taxpayer dollars by not allowing declawing is a win for everybody.
Well, that all makes a lot of sense. I sort of hold my breath as I ask this. Where do you see Florida in the overall process of maybe eventually implementing a ban?
I think Florida cares about its cats. I think that Florida Republicans feel that there's a right for cats to protect themselves, to bear arms. And I think that we just have to have a legislator who cares enough to push it forward without these loopholes. So I think Florida could do it. I think that every state could do it. We just have to find the legislator who cares enough to push it forward.
And is that a lot of what you and the Paw Project at large are often spending a lot of your time and energy on, is identifying those kind of legislators in various states who would hopefully become that kind of author?
Yes, and we look for people to email us and ask and tell us about someone who, even on a city level, a city council person who feels this way about cats. And that's how we start, is we start to educate them. And we can do a lot because we're right. There's no reason to allow declawing. It doesn't help anyone. Even those veterinarians who are making $900 by doing it, they'll make more money by not doing it because they'll retain the patients. The patients will not be killed because of the fact that they're not using the box. The patients, meaning the cats, will not be killed because they're not using the box or biting. And so they'll get more money because they'll keep the patient for the whole 18 years or 20 years that a cat can live, rather than having the patient the $900 and then losing the cat patient forever.
Wow. Let me just quickly let people know, we're sort of in the last moment or two of our time here together, Dr. Conrad. But again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Jennifer Conrad, veterinarian, founder of the Paw Project, and who has worked tirelessly for years, call attention to the often debilitating procedure of declawing cats, and has been central to the creation of legislation outlining the procedure in many states, California being just the most recent. So we have just a minute or two, but if you have something you'd like to ask or a comment to Dr. Conrad, you can call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So, Dr. Conrad, with all the effort and time this takes, all the advocacy, anti-declaw advocacy and related efforts, do you still have time to practice at all? Do you practice on some level, or is that just like not?
Oh, yeah. I work actually in doing rehab for animals. So after surgeries, when they need to strengthen their legs or their backs, or if they've been hurt, or if they need pain management, they're geriatric. That's what I do. I spend a lot of time in trying to help animals through their pain, and I think that's really rewarding. It's one of the best parts of veterinary medicine, in my opinion, because it's helping innocent little animals to feel better.
Well, that sounds great. Well, we've got sort of, a last-minute call. I'm going to try to squeeze in just in our last remaining moment or two. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Conrad. We have just a moment or two left if you have a question or a comment for
Dr.
Conrad.
Hey, Duncan, I do have a question. This is Mario. So good that you have Dr. Conrad on this morning, because as a cat lover and a cat owner, presently we have four cats. I know that sounds like a lot, my wife and I, and we've worked with St. Francis Animal Rescue here. I've learned the delicate art of trapping and fostering and just doing all the wonderful things that's required when the feral cats are in the community, to get them spayed and neutered so that we can try to control that population. Also, as a cat owner for the last 30 years, I came to the realization, once I heard that declawing the cats was actually an amputation, I regretted it miserably, because we did declaw two of our cats, but we have seen the light and we have reformed. I just want to thank Dr. Conrad for the show today, you as well, Duncan.
Thank you.
And to let you know that we're listening, we do care deeply, and, continue the great work. Thank you, Dr. Conrad, for this show today and for informing the public about the importance of not declawing felines.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. Thank you for what you do, and I hope that if we can make it illegal, you'll feel better, because every cat that you adopt out will not, there's no chance that they'll get declawed.
All right, thanks again, Mario. So, okay, Dr. Conrad, we have reached the end of our time, but I just got a late-breaking email from a local animal welfare advocate and a cat person saying we need Ken Hagen in the legislature, so that might be someone identified when you're looking for authors for the Florida bill to keep in mind. Ken Hagen, H-A-G-A-N. So,
thank you so much.
You bet. So, Dr. Conrad, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals. I think hopefully we cover a little bit different ground each time, even though we obviously cover the core stuff consistently because it's such important information. And always more people learning about what decloud really means and avoiding it in the future, just like Mario just mentioned. So it's all to the good. So this has been Dr. Jennifer Conrad. The PAW Project is pawproject.org. And there's all kinds of information about how you can get involved, legislation that's going on or pending, and states that have passed the kind of legislation that we're hoping more and more states, including Florida, will pass. So thank you again for your time and all your effort and expertise, Dr. Conrad.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. In a moment, I'll speak with Rick Shabity, president of Suncoast Animal League. We'll hear about Dogtoberfest and Ride for the Animals. Happening this, they're back and happening this Saturday, November 15th at Highlander Park in Dunedin. WNF will have a table there, by the way, presided over much of the day by Bev Capshaw, who, of course, hosts this show in my absence. And so swing by on Saturday and say hi to Bev at the table at the Oktoberfest. Meanwhile, we'll hear from Rick in a moment about those events and talking animals on WNF. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner. Brian Simpson and part of a piece I'm calling Missing Pets in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Yeah. I don't help people when their pets go missing. Now, when I see one of those signs and it's like lost dog, I'm like, all right, that's one side of the story. You're using the word lost, but what if I asked the dog, maybe he escaped? You know? Those people want you to think their dog's biggest problem is it can't find them. But I saw this documentary, it turns out the average canine can recognize a familiar scent for up to 13 miles, for up to 48 hours. So maybe your dog know exactly where you are. Yeah. You just can't handle the fact that he chose the streets.
That was Brian Simpson in today's Comedy Corner with a piece I'm calling Missing Pets, taken from a performance on the late lamented David Spade show, Lights Out. Now it's time to speak with Rick Shabity, who leads Suncoast Animal League, about the Oktoberfest and Ride for the Animals, both happening this Saturday, November 15th. Let's hear more right now by welcoming Rick Shabity back to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us again on Good. Talking Animals.
Not a problem.
So I always think it's valuable for the audience to be reintroduced to an organization we've met previously one or more times on the show. So maybe we could just start with a brief overview of Suncoast Animal League. What is it, a bit of history and or its mission?
Well, the Suncoast Animal League is an animal shelter. We, you know, take in cats and dogs, sometimes wildlife, sometimes exotic animals. We will be celebrating our 19th anniversary come December 2nd. Of this year, so we've been around for a while. Of course, we're a nonprofit organization. We're a no-kill shelter, and you know, our goal is basically to when we receive animals, cats or dogs, whatever it may be, our goal is to make them better for their stay with us. And so we spend a lot of money on vet bills and such, and we want to make them whole. So, you know, we get a cat or dog that comes in, they've been hit by a car, they have a badly broken leg or something. We do our best to try to save that leg, and probably 95% of the time, because of the efforts put in by everybody, including the veterinarians and such, that, you know, we make it happen. The animal ends up getting adopted and walking out on all fours.
Well, that's great. And I imagine to sustain the cost of an organization that does those kinds of things, there typically needs to be at least one or more major fundraisers each year, which I believe probably brings us to the Oktoberfest, probably fitting that description, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Now, we haven't been able, you know, because of COVID, and then, of course, then last year the hurricane, so we haven't been able to do it every year like we always have, but you know, this is going to be our 16th year doing Dogtoberfest.
And fill us in a little bit on what that involves.
Basically, you know, it's a family fun day. You know, it's obviously pet friendly. It's kind of a dog event. Yeah, I mean, we have a ton of vendors. We have lure coursing. We have blessing of the animals. We have different games that are going on. We have all kinds of photo opportunities. We have photos with Santa. We have dog adoptions. We've got food trucks. We have beer tents. You know, it's just it's from 11 to 5 at Highlander Park in Dunedin. And it's just a kind of family-friendly, pet-friendly event that you can just come in, relax, have a great time with your family and your dog.
It sounds great. And also, I know it's kind of considered a dog festival, but I noticed the poster for this coming Saturday's event looks like a cat has climbed in and helped edit the poster and say it's a dog and cat festival. So obviously you must have heard from the angry cat lobby.
Oh, you're exactly right, Duncan. So we have a, you know, although cats don't travel well like dogs do and such, but we have a large cat booth there. It doesn't necessarily mean any cats will be there, but just pictures of our adoptables to remind people that, you know, cats are available for adoption. You know, we have 3 different PetSmart stores, and we have the cat rooms in there. And we're getting ready to open up a cat cafe. So we probably receive in a year's time more cats than we do dogs.
Yeah. Well, this sounds great, and it sounds like the cats are definitely going to get equal time here this weekend to the extent possible. So,
one other thing, Duncan, one of the things that's really cool is we have an alumni parade, and that's not all the dogs, but dogs that have been adopted throughout our 19 years. And it's pretty emotional to see these guys that went out as maybe 8 or 9 week old puppies and now they're back as, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-old dogs and to see them with their families.
That's great.
You know, successful, that kind of thing.
So that must be really moving to see those dogs parade by.
It really true.
So one other thing that's happening this weekend before we run out of time here, Rick, is the ride for the animals is also mm-hmm. back in full swing. So talk a little bit about what that is and how that works.
Well, basically, it's part of the fundraiser, and it's a really huge event for us. And, you know, basically we have 4 different rides. We have one that's 12 miles, one 31 miles, one 55 miles, and one 62 miles. And that starts early in the morning. Sign-in begins at 7:30 at Highlander Park. And then the 8:15 is the 62 milers. They take off at that time. And then, the times... You got the 55 at 8:15, also 31 miles at 8:45, and the 12 miles at 10 o'clock. And again, it really helps us with fundraising. And we actually have people that come in from all over the country to be a part of this. You know, it's not a race. It's just a ride.
Yeah.
It's very successful.
And how many animal organizations offer cycling events like Ride for the Animals?
Seems
kind of rare to me.
It is. It's not, you know, it's a lot to put together to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But it's been very successful. I think this is our 16th year doing this, and every year it builds. Now, since COVID, a lot of cycling events from around the country are down 20% or so.
Sure.
But we're looking at a pretty good turnout for Saturday.
Well, this all sounds great. It sounds like it's going to be a huge day with a lot of cool fun and all kinds of activities and events to choose from. So
and
you can go
weather.
To...
And the weather's going to cooperate.
Yeah, it looks like you're set for some great weather. So if anybody wants to find out more or go over some of the details we discussed, you can go to suncoastanimalleague.org, and there's sections within that and there are events for the Dogtoberfest and the Ride for the Animals, so you can get all set up in advance for Saturday. So, Rick, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals, and good luck on Saturday.
Oh, thank you, buddy. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation. Great show hosted by Myra Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNS Brief News Recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Ball, only fourth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And it just continues that way with all kinds of great music on 88.5 WMNF after that. We have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF. We hope you'll tune in next Wednesday for more, hopefully, great animal programming. And meanwhile, stay tuned for the conversation coming up.